dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The American Heritage Dictionary defines the term Potemkin Village as a noun, something that appears elaborate and impressive, but in actual fact lacks substance. The term is based on an historical incident. In 1787, when Catherine the Great visited the Ukraine and the Crimea, Prince Grigory Alexandrovich Potemkin, a Russian army officer, statesman, and her lover, decided to put up elaborate cardboard houses apparently full of splendor in the villages Catherine was shown. While this setup depicted an illusion of prosperity, the real condition of the village was hidden behind this facade. Tonight, travels in a Potemkin nation. This story went out on the Associated Press wire service on November 30th. Florida shoppers trample woman in line for bargain DVD. Orange City, Florida. A mob of shoppers rushing for a sale on DVD players trampled the first woman in line and knocked her unconscious as they scrambled for the shelves at a Walmart supercenter. Patricia Van Lester had her eye on a $29 DVD player. But when the siren blared at 6 a.m. Friday announcing the start to the post-Thanksgiving Day sale, the 41-year-old was knocked to the ground by the frenzy of shoppers behind her. She got pushed down and they walked over her like a herd of elephants, said Van Lester's sister, Linda Elsie. I told them, "Stop stepping on my sister, she's on the ground." Elsie said some shoppers tried to help Van Lester, and one employee helped Elsie reach her sister, but most people just continued their rush for deals. All they cared about was a stupid DVD player, she said Saturday. Paramedics called to the store found Van Lester unconscious on top of a DVD player, surrounded by shoppers seemingly oblivious to her, said Mark O'Keefe, a spokesman for EVAC Ambulance. She was flown to Halifax Medical Center in Daytona Beach, where doctors told the family Van Lester had a seizure after she was knocked down and would likely remain hospitalized through the weekend, Elsie said. Hospital officials said Saturday they did not have any information on her condition. She's all black and blue, Elsie said. Patty doesn't remember anything. She still can't believe it all happened. Elsie said Walmart officials called her later Friday to ask about her sister, and the store apologized and offered to put a DVD player on hold for her. Walmart store spokesman Karen Burke said she'd never heard of such a melee during a sale. "We are very disappointed this happened," Burke said. "We want her to come back as a shopper." From the Associated Press on November 30th. Given what so-called ordinary law-abiding Americans were willing to do to get a DVD on sale, what will those with similar values do when in a position to gain billions of dollars by seizing control of the bulk of the world's remaining easily accessible oil fields? Will they deliberately allow the deaths of thousands of the people they're sworn to protect in order to launch a world war on terrorism as a cloak for their schemes? Yes, says 9/11 widow Ellen Mariani, who's filed a lawsuit against George Bush and his administration. She and her attorney spoke with the IE America Radio Network's Mike Malloy last week.
Louis Neil Mariani died on September 11, 2001, when United Airlines Flight 175 was flown into the South Tower of the World Trade Center. His wife, Ellen, and her attorney, Philip Berg, had a press conference on November 26 in Philadelphia, a news conference, I should say, where it was announced that Mrs. Mariani has filed a Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, that is the RICO Act. Under that act, has filed a federal court complaint against George W. Bush and members of his cabinet, including but not limited to Dick Cheney, John Ashcroft, Donald Rumsfeld, and others. The suit alleges that, one, they had knowledge and warnings of 911 and failed to warn or take steps to prevent. Two, they have been covering up the truth of 911. And three, have therefore violated the laws of the United States. And four, therefore are being sued under the RICO Act. Joining us now is Ellen Mariani, wife of Louis Mariani. She joins us from New Hampshire. And joining us from Philadelphia is her attorney, Louis Philip Berg. Welcome to both of you. Thanks for taking the time to join us.
Our pleasure.
Can you tell us, and by the way, Mrs. Mariani, the open letter that you wrote to the President of the United States the other night, I read it in its entirety on this program. It was very moving and very to the point, and I guess that would be a good place to start with the first question. And please excuse what sounds like naivete in this question, but I'd like to hear it in your own words. What is your goal with this lawsuit?
Well, from day one, I'm like everybody else. Be patient, be understanding, and everything will come out okay. We will find out the truth. Well, it's been over 2 years. It'll be the third birthday I've missed in the Christmas of my husband, who I've went off being married and come back a widow. I want the truth, and I have sat in two hearings in New York federal courts. I have watched, I have listened, and it isn't the way it's going.
Mm-hmm.
I want the truth.
It must be awfully discouraging to witness the president, the vice president, first of all, notifying leading members of Congress not to investigate too deeply into this tragedy, to further see the president, vice president, and cabinet members withholding documentation. And I guess to a lesser extent, but equally egregious, up until the past couple of days, the mayor of New York refusing to release information necessary for this 911 investigation. That has got to be unnerving.
That hurt, I'll tell you. That hurt me right to the core, to how they were manipulating in the courts. But I'll tell you something, those that are listening tonight, you better be really alert and watching and asking many questions, because the new laws that they put in are really smarting us,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
to the point we have lost a lot of our rights. And if my attorney can explain from those lobbyists running through the halls to get that stabilization bill in to protect, number one, the airlines that we're still using every day, to the Patriot and the Homeland Security. That right now is very alarming. And please, if you can, Phil Berg, explain it to Mike and his audience.
Well, that would be a good starting point. The attorney for Ellen Mariani is Philip Berg. If you would expand on what Mrs. Mariani just said, Mr. Berg.
Sure. Well, the Stabilization Act was created a week or two after 9/11, and what it really, the real effect of it is, I mean, it was told, it was done to make it easier for the survivors. They would create a fund and, you know, to work out for the family's needs. First off, there's been delays by the fund. The fund is called the Feinberg Fund because Kenneth Feinberg is the one individual who has been appointed, to make the final decision of someone's worth based,
mm-hmm,
upon their age and their income. And
now, this was money to go to the survivors of the victims of 911.
That's correct.
Okay.
And Feinberg is the sole decider of how much money. If someone's making a certain income and deducted from that is the life insurance payments and pension payments and different things. But the bigger effect of that is that if you go into the fund, you state that you will not sue anybody.
Right.
You will not sue the airlines. You will not sue, in effect, the insurance company. So it was really created to save the airlines and to save the insurance companies behind them. And it also meant you couldn't sue the federal government, nobody.
Mm-hmm.
But the real purpose behind it, it's our belief when our research is, to circumvent the truth. Because by not suing, then you're not doing discovery.
Mm-hmm.
If you're doing a lawsuit, you can, through the power of depositions or interrogatories. Interrogatories is a written question to someone, and depositions is oral statements to a sworn witness, and subpoena power to try to seek out the truth. And it's our position that the truth has not been given, and I'm sure about 80% of the people in the country believe, or probably up to 95%, believe that the truth was not told. Some people will say, well, I really don't want to know, but you should know, and we should find out. Then after that, the Patriot Act was created, and that basically just takes away rights from people. As I'm talking to you on the phone right now, they could come into my office and just take me away and say I'm a subversive, that I'm against the United States, put me in jail, not allow me to speak to an attorney, and not even ever bring me to trial. Now, these things are frightening, and as Ellen Mariani, my lovely client, said, these are scary. And now they just passed the Patriot Act 2. They just slid through a few weeks ago. I haven't even had time to read it. But our rights are being taken away daily. Now, what we're looking for in this lawsuit is to find out the truth. And people can say, well, what's the truth? Well, the truth is, number one, the United States of America and George Bush, and under the National Security Act of 1947, he is responsible for everyone under him. But we, in our complaint, which is on various places on the net, we will be having a website up shortly, in 62 pages of our complaint, we set forth 100 distinct items that the Bush and the administration was aware of the comings of 9/11 before it happened.
Mm-hmm.
And they protected themselves, but they didn't warn or try to protect the citizens of this country. And people say, well, you know, you can't protect. You couldn't have stopped this. Our belief is we could have.
Yeah. Let me ask you this, Mr. Berg. The Paula Jones case, through a ruling by the United States Supreme Court, and if I remember right, it was unanimous ruling, a sitting president can be sued in a civil case. And prior to that action against President Clinton, it was just, I guess, assumed that the duties of, you know, the president represents the entire executive branch of the government. Therefore, the duties of the president superseded civil lawsuits. But since the right wing in this country pushed the issue and got their Supreme Court ruling, do you anticipate any problem in deposing George W. Bush or Dick Cheney as a result of that Supreme Court ruling several years ago?
Well, citing that, we shouldn't, but I'm sure they're going to put every roadblock up that they can. They're going to go under the guise of, different than the Paula Jones case, they're going to go under the guise of national security.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to contest that all the way down. I mean, that's the one of the reasons that they have not been forthcoming to the 9/11 Commission, which was appointed by the president. And the 9/11 Commission, one of the most outspoken individuals on that was Max Cleland,
right,
who in effect was just bought off by the president and offered him a nice position, and he just left the commission.
And I fault former Senator Cleland for doing that. He's a senator from my state until he was defeated, in my opinion, with some question about how the voting was tabulated here by Saxby Chambliss. But it's a shame that one of the most vocal critics of George Bush has, as you put it, been bought off. Mrs. Mariani, if I may, tell us a little bit about your husband.
He was a neat guy. As a lot of all the 3,000 that were murdered. He was 58 years old. I miss it terrible. We kissed goodbye and hugged and see you 3 minutes after our planes get in. And he's no longer anywhere. We have found nothing of my husband. All they've done is all the remains that they say they can't identify through DNA, which there was done a DNA for him, are in this pile of fresh kill over in New York, and that was one of the things that I want them brought back, and I want them to have a memorial type place that we can go and pray or whatever. We don't want them left over in some island in a dump and then put so many feet of cement on top of them. These are human beings, our loved ones. Mm-hmm. And I miss him terrible.
Had you spoken to him on September 11th?
I left 2 hours before his plane did.
Tell him where you were going, Ellen.
We were going to my daughter's wedding in California, and he never made it, of course. And then I was determined I would make it because I was like everybody else, believing it was terrorists, and we're not allowing terrorists to stop us in our tracks with fear. And I continued on to the wedding for that Saturday, and after being stranded for 4 days, you know, it is sad that we had to find out later that the president had a lot of his family, friends, and acquaintance from years back of the bin Ladens and whomever they snuck him out of our country when the rest of us are like little, I don't know what you'd call us, nothing.
One of the most horrific aftershocks of that attack on this country was the fact that members of the bin Laden family and the Saudi royal family were allowed to fly out of this country with executive branch permission while Americans were grounded.
You know, while Ellen was stuck in grieving in Chicago with her family out in California, she couldn't fly, but the bin Laden family gets the official Bush send-off, and they're allowed to fly out of the country when other planes aren't flying.
I was sitting outside the classroom waiting to go in, and I saw an airplane hit the tower of a TV. You know, the TV was obviously on, and I used to fly myself, and I said, well, there's one terrible pilot. I was sitting in the classroom, and Andy Card, my chief of staff, who was sitting over here, walked in and said, a second plane has hit the tower. America's under attack.
You just heard that soundbite, both of you, that Bush made. And the question, of course, that has come up many times in this program is how George Bush could be the only person in the known universe to see the first plane hit the first tower on television.
Isn't that amazing?
It is amazing. It is amazing. I don't think I need to preface it by saying arguably there was no television report on that first hit. It wasn't arguably. There just simply was not. What is it, Mrs. Mariani, that you ultimately want as a result of this lawsuit?
It is simply the truth. It is so easy to say simply the truth when he said to the world he would hunt down whoever was responsible and bring them to justice. Okay, Mr. Bush, you have blocked us. You have blocked every way that we've tried to get the truth in these hearings in New York. Tell us why. Mm-hmm. What is it they're afraid of? Mm-hmm. If there is nothing to be afraid of, come out and tell us how this all came about where we were not protected, when we are the most sophisticated and the most powerful armed forces, all the planes and NORAD and everything, nothing worked that day. Tell us why.
Well, we believe the truth is that Bush knew about this, unfortunately, and they were looking for this to him, and the group around him was looking to create an IWT, International War of Terrorism, which has gone on. And examples of that are the fact that within hours after the planes hit, I think it was still that day or the next day, the administration stated they knew that they knew who did it. They knew already who did it. Now, how'd they know that fast? Meanwhile, no one 2.5 years later, 2.25 years later, has been brought to justice. They knew to go in and attack Afghanistan. They knew that weapons of mass destruction were in Iraq, and the reason I'm saying this being facetious, these all turned out to be lies.
Right.
There were no weapons of mass destruction. And someone asked me yesterday, they said, well, if you claim that Bush is so smart to be involved that he knew about this was going to occur in 9/11, wouldn't he be smart enough to put a truckload of weapons of mass destruction of chemicals in Iraq and come out as a hero.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, let me think about that. I'll have to do some research. I said, you know what? I think they tried, but thank God there are honest men and women in our military service who probably prevented anything like that happening over in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And Iraq, I mean, I think we should support our troops completely that are there, but it bothers me every day when we lose another man or woman over there. It's a horrendous thing that Bush has pushed us into. His win earlier this year was that they agreed to go back in to allow inspectors back in Iraq. But that wasn't good enough. They had to go in. They had to start this war. And to the detriment of the people in this country, but to the benefit, and that's part of our lawsuit, of people close to Bush and close to Cheney, Halliburton, where Cheney used to work and was part of, and we understand he still has 26,000 shares of stock, they received no-bid contracts to go into Iraq, and that's what the administration's been giving out to mm-hmm. their friends.
Right, exactly.
And they're making a lot of money on this.
Well, I have put it similar to a chess game.
A chess game?
They're just playing mind games. We believed it. We trusted. And now we're seeing that it is not true. We're not going to bring our loved ones back. We want it stopped. We want those brought forward. Like he said, he was going to hunt down and punish. Mm-hmm. Well, we've waited patiently over 2 years, 2 months, and so many hours. Nothing has been done. They've gone over to other countries and tore them to bits.
Mm-hmm.
We've now got a $87 billion deficit now, or whatever it is that we got to pay for. It's time for us to hunt down and punish.
Yeah, but see, the problem is they don't have to go that far to hunt. They just have to, Mike and Ellen, they just have to bring everyone in from their various departments in Washington,
right,
and get them to open up and tell the truth. And we're hoping through this lawsuit, we've started our website, hopefully we're trying to get it cleared, it's going to be called 9-11 for the Truth. And if I just may mention, we're trying to, it's going to be a lot to fund this because the government's going to do everything against us as possible. And we came up with $9.11 we're asking people to send in to help us defray the cost of this, because we want to take the depositions, we want to issue subpoenas, and we, more important, what we want is all the listeners out there to start talking to their family and friends and ask the question, we really don't know what happened on 9/11, and shouldn't we find out, and do we want our rights taken away? And one of the reasons I filed here in Philadelphia the lawsuit, the second lawsuit, and the one against Bush and the administration, is that the Declaration of Independence was hammered out here in Philadelphia and signed, and the United States Constitution. And to do that, people stood up and rebelled. And it's time the people in this country stood up and rebelled against the nonsense and the taking away of rights for the elite.
The news conference that you had Wednesday before Thanksgiving, the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, a two-part question. How well attended was that by the news media, A? B, I have seen nothing about your lawsuit on CNN, MSNBC, CBS, ABC, NBC. How is it being received by the so-called liberal media in this country?
Well, unfortunately, they're not, and that's one of our big claims. Some of my advisors are suggesting to me that I join some of these elite media into the lawsuit as far as the ongoing suppression of evidence, because they have a responsibility here to do things. We are getting better press coverage overseas in England and the Netherlands and in Germany than we are here in the United States, and that's why it's thrilling to be on a show like yours and that you have guts enough to open up and allow us to speak these.
Why do you think that is, Mr. Berg? Why is American media or why are American media not covering this?
Well, I think part of it comes down to that too few own too much in this country. And as we named one of our defendants here, the Council on Foreign Relations. And the Council on Foreign Relations is made up of a lot of individuals who are heads of these various corporations that own CBS and ABC and NBC. And we're going to keep kicking at them. We are prodding and doing, and there's people out there, versus talk show hosts like you, and a lot of people out there. A thing that has changed, I think, forever, and hopefully for the better, is the Internet. the Internet has enabled people to spread the word, spread the message very fast and very cheap. And our message is getting around to, and I know by the emails we're getting, but thousands and thousands of people. And within days, we know that we can send a message out and 100,000 or 200,000 or a million people can get it. And our vast reaches through the various conducts that we're doing, we know that we're reaching out to thousands of people and hopefully millions of people in this country and around the world. And we just want them to unite and stand up and say, you know what? Tell us the truth. See, this is our position. If George Bush would come out in the administration and lay out everything they have and show us we're wrong, we would withdraw this lawsuit. But we know that they won't because they can't, because they knew about things. And certain things, for instance, in July of 2001, Ashcroft, the Attorney General of the United States, stopped flying commercial aircraft.
Right.
And he started flying military charters. Well, why? Because they had four warnings in June, July, August. The administration had warnings. George Bush had warnings from even the German officials. And we have it documented in our complaint that planes were going to be utilized to go into buildings in the United States. And, you know, we have fighter jets in this country. And everyone has seen them because they see them being utilized over in Iraq. Why were these planes told to stand down on September 11th? And they were.
Yeah, those questions have been thoroughly documented on the Internet. I would hope that as a result of your lawsuit, there might be some answers. We've got a couple of email questions here. Barry in Montgomery, Alabama, emails in, would you ask your guests if any current or former intelligence officials have been helpful in your efforts?
We have gotten some input. I'm not sure from intelligence people. We've gotten some input already from former U.S. attorneys, other individuals, attorneys around the country who are willing to come forth and help. And that's another thing we're asking, and through your show and other shows, that there are people out there in this country who probably know something, who saw something on September 11th or before that time that has information that's been afraid to turn it over to the government. If they could contact you or contact me and give us affidavits about it, because we know that people have knowledge about things if they think hard enough, because this goes back to 1993 when they tried to blow up the World Trade Center. And they were told at that time, we found out, that they had planned to use planes to go into the Sears Tower and the World Trade Center. Right now, no intelligence. Well, we do have an affidavit even from someone in intelligence. So, yes, we do.
Daryl is calling from Detroit. Daryl, welcome to the program. You have a question for our guest.
I wanted to let you know, you and your lawyer, that I had for a long time been in a chat with a person that I really don't know, but was an American Airlines stewardess or worked in the airplanes. And she said that they were under an agreement. They had to actually sign papers to say that they would not talk about what happened on that day. And they have been, she said, it is so damaging that people are really afraid of retribution, like being suicided and other things of that nature. I don't know if you were aware of the fact that there are American Airlines personnel who know a lot.
Well, we would love to hear from them, one way or the other, if they could start out with a, you know, making up a secret name and contacting us. I would love to hear from them, because to go along with that, and Mike, to pass on to your listeners, the other day I got an email from an official of the 28,000 airport screeners who were basically the scapegoats of 9/11. And they've been in contact with us, and they want to support us in our attempt to find out the truth. And let me just raise an issue to your listeners. What evidence do we have that a box, that any box cutter was being used on any of these planes?
Right.
Now, supposedly the only thing we know is there was a phone call that supposedly said a box cutter was used to harm a stewardess. Even if we believe that, how do we then know that they were used on all four planes? And this was another bit of propaganda, we believe, put out by the administration. If not, let us see the proof. But there's no proof. So it's just, and because of that, the screeners, and the only thing that's really happened at the airports, in our opinion, is that the businesses inside the airports have lost money, closed down. We don't really think security is really better at the airports. I'm not trying to scare people, but what you're dealing with is terrorists, like what goes on overseas, they want to come in with a backpack and blow themselves up.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
That really hasn't been prevented. The only thing that's been prevented is supposedly taking certain things onto planes.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't really think that that's the problem.
Is Daryl still on?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah. Daryl, you are telling me the truth. I have been amongst some of the widowers, also who had husbands that were pilots. And when I would walk or approach near them, they would turn their back and walk away. And I thought, oh, well, you know, they maybe feel that their husbands killed our loved ones. And that's how I felt at first. You are exactly correct. They did do something, like they did sign something. They're also afraid that whatever monies they were going to get, they might lose if they say the wrong thing.
Well, these were even people who were not even involved in the flights. This is throughout the country. These were not people whose relatives were on the flights. These are other flight personnel who are associated with the airline.
Mm-hmm.
And they've reached out and clamped down on this. And this has been in place for over a year. I mean, this was not a... They were not sloppy with this.
I would think, let me interrupt if I may. I would think, Mr. Berg, that when you get your website up, information like that which Daryl's talking about would be appreciated at your website or through an email once people know how to get in touch with you. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah. Daryl, let me move on. Thanks,
yeah,
Daryl.
Sure.
I appreciate
care.
It.
Thanks, Daryl.
You know, it brings up a question, the conversation you were having there with Daryl. And I can ask either one of you, Mrs. Mariani or Mr. Berg, do you believe the story? And I'm not putting quotes around the word story. I'm just saying, do you believe the story that 19 people commandeered 4 jetliners in this country, 15 of whom were from Saudi Arabia, and that the destruction and death that occurred in this country on September 11th was carried out as the story has laid it out, that these 4 people, suicide bombers all, took over 4 jetliners and slammed them into the Pentagon, the World Trade Center, and the ground in Pennsylvania. Do you believe that story, essentially?
No, I don't.
And I do not.
Do you believe something else that you can share here?
Can I ask Mr. President, why hasn't he given us a complete passengers list from all the flights? He will not do that. Why? Also, the airport surveillance tapes, when they were what they would have shown all the passengers boarding these doomed flights. Why won't he release those?
Do you have any thought as to the answer to that question, Mrs. Mariani? Why he would not, or why whomever has these tapes in custody, why they would not be released? Do you have
because they're probably not going to show these terrorists that they're so-called claiming were on there, because I believe, am I right, Phil, some of these terrorists are alive and they're in for fear of their own life because of how Bush has gone over there and destroyed.
We have heard, and again, we have to document it further, but we've heard up to 7 of these supposed terrorists are still alive and well and flying planes or in Saudi Arabia. You know, it's really, as Ellen mentioned, they show you some photos of some people getting on or off an airplane going through the airport in Maine. Now, if they have videotapes in Maine, I'm sure they have in Boston's Logan Airport. They haven't shown any of those, as Ellen said.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't produced the flight manifest of everything. There's so many unanswered questions, more unanswered questions than questions. And I think another thing to show that the president was involved, the president, if he's ever in danger, is not... He doesn't call his own decisions. They're called for by the Secret Service. And it boggles our mind why at 9:03, when the second plane hit the World Trade Center, that the chief of staff just whispers in his ear and the president goes back reading a ghost story, when in effect he should have, number one, taken command And more important, the Secret Service should have just grabbed him out of that room and put him someplace else, out of that building, because everyone in the United States or world knew he was in that classroom that day.
Mm-hmm. Mrs. Mariani, in your open letter to the president, where you have seven questions, in the seventh one, why did your brother Jeb go to the offices of the Hoffman Aviation School and order that the flight records be removed and flown from this country? That has got to be a clear indication of some sort of a conspiracy. I mean, even if we don't use the legal term, just in the sense of, gee, they conspired to do something, that must be very puzzling to you.
It's very sad. And I think we've got to stop turning our back. We've got to stand up and demand the truth. You know, why, for his brother, who is the president of the United States, why would he take one of our government C-130 cargo planes and fly out of our country all the flight records and files? Why? What are they hiding? What is in there? It's simply, we want the truth.
Mm-hmm.
It's sad because I feel that our country abandoned us, 3,000 families that had our loved ones just ripped from us. And we need people to walk with us.
Yeah.
Can I give an address if people want to send us anything until we get our website up?
Yes, you may. How about your AOL email address?
Sure. PJB Law. That's P for Peter, J like jam, B like butter, law. PJBLaw@AOL.com.
That was Mike Malloy on the IE America Radio Network. If you'd like to hear Mike Malloy's daily talk show on IE America Radio, it airs weeknights from 9 to midnight Eastern Time and can be accessed online at ieamericaradio.com. That's ieamericaradio.com. The ultimate Potemkin village, the American suburb, is a product of the age of cheap oil and is doomed to go down with it as the next decade ushers in the end of the age of cheap oil. So says new urbanist James Howard Kunstler, author of Geography of Nowhere, Home from Nowhere, and The City in Mind. He spoke with Canadian journalist Julian Darley last March. Darley begins with a question.
So my first question is, how do you understand oil peak, and why do you take it seriously when so many others don't?
How do I understand oil peak? Well, I understand it the way it has been presented to me. It seems to me that the people who have presented this to the public, namely Colin Campbell and the group surrounding him, have made a compelling case that's hard to ignore, given who they are and their credentials and the case that they present. So, you know, I proceed with my ideas simply by accepting their premises and finding alternate explanations to be inadequate. Why do I take it seriously? Well, some years ago when I started looking into the issues that I write about, namely the fiasco of suburbia in America, I pursued that because when I was a newspaper reporter beginning in the 1970s, and I lived and worked through the oil embargo of 1973 and had a very vivid memory of what happened. It seemed to me that the way America was arranging everyday life, the great suburban build-out, represented a tremendous economic, political, social, and ecological catastrophe. And I agonized for many years wondering where it was leading us, you know, that feeling that you get when you're out on a freeway and you're a young man and you see just these wave upon waves of cars coming at you day after day after day, and you wonder, is this what it's going to be like 11 years from now, 23 years from now, 50 years from now? Where does it end? Because it can't go on like this forever. And the economy that was associated with it seemed to me to be a pathological economy. So I was fascinated by that. And that's what I set out to explore in my books, Geography of Nowhere and Home from Nowhere. And, of course, you know, the oil supply is at the bottom of it. And the fact that we can now, in retrospect, identify these extraordinary conditions of the 20th century as being the cheap oil age, and especially the conditions in the second half of the 20th century, and being a very special set of circumstances that created a very special kind of growth medium and allowed us here in America to behave a certain way and make certain choices. And altogether, I think it's had a very baleful effect on American civilization. And we have now reached a kind of crossroads where we are faced with a set of very important choices. And if we fail to make the right ones, American civilization may not really be carried on the way we might have liked it to be. So that's where I'm coming from on that.
And coming out of that, and especially out of the fact that you mentioned that some of the other suggestions weren't as compelling, one of the places where people find solace in this is the fact that we've managed to substitute before, when oil got problematic in the 70s, why there was gas, and we dashed for that, and that was splendid. And then there's solar, you know, more sunlight hits the earth in a day than we could conceive of using in goodness knows how many dozens of years. So this is all splendid, and, you know, there's hydrogen everywhere. Clearly it's all around the universe, and we're probably practically made of it, so hydrogen's going to be super. And then there's fusion and methane hydrates. There's an endless list of things which are plainly going to save us, and it's all going to be excellent. And then there's nuclear and so forth. What are your feelings about all these wonderful substitutes which are in fact going to save us?
I regard them as very unfortunate fantasies. It doesn't take a lot of technical expertise or scientific education to understand, for example, what an energy sink is. The fact is that, with my limited expertise, it's obvious that none of these alternatives, as we know them or can even conceive of them within the limits of what we know, none of these things scale, really. They don't pencil out. You may be able to create a fuel cell prototype car in a laboratory, but can you manufacture 100 million of them to substitute for what we're running now? I think the answer is clearly no, we can't. And we certainly can't scale up solar in any way that would be an adequate replacement for the way we are running things. That's really the big question. Can we continue running things the way we have with these substitutes? And the answer is no. And it's sort of the dirty secret of the American predicament is that our economy is now based almost entirely on the creation of suburban sprawl, on the servicing of it, and the furnishing of it. You know, we've outsourced all of our manufacturing, well, a lot of our manufacturing. It's really not fair to say all of it, but enough of it to have reduced its significance. So we've now got an economy that is based on suburban sprawl, but what makes it even more problematic is that all the wealth that we've been investing in it also represents, at the same time, a tremendous, monumental misallocation of resources. We've been investing all of our national wealth for the last 50 years in the infrastructure for a daily life that has no future. There's no future in the suburban sprawl way of life, and that's where all of our money is. And so not only are we running our economy on it, but we've also stuck all our wealth in it. And that is the real tragedy of where we're at now, because the fabric of our daily life, the suburban cul-de-sacs, the strip malls, the parking lagoons, the commercial highway strips, you know, all of the stuff that Americans are familiar with as the daily setting of their lives, really does not lend itself to retrofitting for a different kind of future, for a more energy-efficient future, or a different kind of energy future. So what I imagine is that it's going to represent a kind of an economic catastrophe as its disutility becomes manifest and its associated value vanishes. And the people who have invested their life savings in things like McHouses and suburban property of all kinds are going to find that they've been ruined and impoverished by this misinvestment. And I think the net effect is we're going to see a mad scramble in the suburbs as people try to get out. And, of course, there are going to be very few buyers for this stuff, and the value of all the property of all kinds, commercial, residential, office, you name it, is going to crash. And there's going to be kind of fight over the table scraps of the 20th century out there. And it's going to be very messy. It's going to create a huge amount of political distress, recrimination, finger-pointing, scapegoating. My own theory is that Americans will vote for cornpone Nazis who will promise to restore the golden age of the 90s, and of course that will be a promise they will not be able to keep. We're going to see a new class of Americans who I call the formerly middle class, and they're going to feel a tremendous sense of having been swindled out of their entitlements to the American dream, which is to say the life of the drive-in utopia, the life of suburban sprawl, which the world will no longer permit them to live in. And they're going to create tremendous domestic political turmoil in the attempt to hold on to those entitlements, which cannot be held on to. So I think it's going to be a big goddamn mess. I think it's probably going to lead to violence. It may lead to some degree to the dissolution of our democratic institutions in the United States. And we may not recognize our nation by the time the dust settles.
You've covered several of my questions. I was going to lead into what do you think will happen to suburbia, but I think you've given us a pretty comprehensive look at that. Is there anything else you want to add to this? I speak from Canada, which is a gigantic suburb.
Well, you know, I've been very active in the new urbanist movement over the last 10 years. It's really a wonderful movement made up of some of the most hopeful and competent and honorable people who I've met in my culture. You know, I'm 54 years old, and these are, in my estimation, just among some of the best of the baby boom generation. You know, people of tremendous skill and ability. And they came along at a time that was kind of crucial. They have been out there in the trenches, sedulously trying to reclaim and restore the whole body of knowledge that we threw in the garbage in 1950, the culture of civic design, which is that body of skill and principle and knowledge and methodology, which allows us to construct meaningful, sustainable, and rewarding human ecologies, namely towns, villages, cities, farming ecologies, you know, rural landscapes, all of the conditions that are found on what we in the New Urbanism call the transect of the human habitat, a continuum that goes from the center of the city to the wilderness and all the conditions in between that obtain. And all the knowledge and skill necessary to produce these things has been put back into service by the new urbanists because we're going to need it desperately. It happens to be the antithesis to the anti-city and the anti-human ecology of suburbia. You know, and all of the principles that go into the making of suburbia are not found in the principles of traditional town planning and traditional urban design. So the new urbanists have been working on this very hard. And I think they've also gone to heroic lengths to try to understand what we're going to do with the existing suburban places. Because, of course, whatever they represent in the form of a misallocation of resources or a misinvestment, there is still, I think, an understandable wish to try to do something with them. And I think that some of them indeed can probably be reused and fixed. There are already projects in existence in which, for example, dead shopping malls are being converted into village centers and town centers with mixed-use development, places for people to live, people of different incomes, houses, apartments, places for businesses to do their thing, retail, you know, all mixed together in an integral way so that these places add up to more than the sum of their parts, which is to say that they come alive as civic organisms, you know. Just as you come alive as a human organism because the organs of your life are integrally deployed around your body. You're more than the sum of the liver and the lungs and the bones and the skin and the muscles. In that way, real human habitat is more than just the sum of its parts. And the whole idea of suburbia for the last 60 years really has been to disaggregate those organic relations between those integral relations between the civic organs, you know, the organs of the residential organs where we have our houses and the commercial organs where the shopping happens, you know, and the educational organs where the schools and the museums are and the cultural organs of the theaters and so on. And, you know, under the regime of single-use zoning, which was the chief governing principle of suburbia, all these things were separated assiduously. And the separation was reinforced with either large streets or formal buffers that took the form of landscaping, fantasias, and things like that. So the main thing about suburbia was it could only be used and accessed by being in an automobile. And that, of course, is its most obvious drawback. And from the standpoint of energy, it's what makes the whole program a complete loser for the future, because we are now stuck in America with tens of thousands of poorly integrated places that can only be used in cars, with massive amounts of mandatory motoring. We're literally stuck up a cul-de-sac in a cement SUV without a fill-up. The new urbanists have tried heroically, as I said, to imagine methods and ways of fixing these places. I think the general point of view among us is that you can do a certain amount of this with malls and some of the commercial stuff. You can retrofit them, you can infill the parking lots, you can create streets and blocks, and eventually even remove the mall buildings and change them out with real urban fabric. But the suburban residential cul-de-sac subdivisions do not offer a whole lot of hope. And I haven't seen one example of anyone who's been able to come up with a scheme for retrofitting them for the future. So I imagine they'll be the slums of the future. My image of it is that where there is now one software engineer living in a McMansion outside of Atlanta, 11 years from now there will be 12 families living in that building, growing Swiss chard where the lawn used to be. And it's kind of a sad and tragic and hopeless and pitiful picture of the future.
You are mentioning things which I have tried to explore with some people who are in the general run of town planning. And one of the things that I notice is that whilst people pay a certain amount of attention when it's mentioned that this is running on a fuel system which is going to run out, apart from its other problems, which you've noted both just now and so eloquently in your books, one's partly talking about an ideology of the general city and town planner, which I think allows them to get jobs and keep their jobs. Part of that ideology, it seems to me, is powered by a profound belief in the market. I even heard, I think it's Professor Severo saying that the market is the test of urban planning and urban design. So if the consumers like it, then it's succeeded, and if they don't, it's failed. And he excoriated the use of steel rails, metal rails, and was as one might expect, deeply in love with the rubber wheel. And I wondered if you could comment on this. This is a whole institution which is pretty much dead set.
Well, you know, these arguments about the marketplace and the idea that suburbia must be okay because that's what people seem to want is transparently an exercise in casuistry and transparently a specious argument. You know, I think what we're really talking about when you clear away all the smoke, what stands behind this in its baleful way is the law of perverse outcomes, which states that people don't get what they expect, but they get what they deserve. A lot of people ascribe the damage that's been done simply to the planning officialdom, but really that's certainly not solely what's responsible, although it really didn't help. What you're seeing is just a tremendous aggregate amount of cultural inertia. The kind of behaviors that end up being expressed in the suburban geography of nowhere, as I call it, of the American landscape and townscape, really represents inertia that's coming from many different parts of our culture. It certainly comes from the planning officials who have their single-use zoning ideology, but it also comes from the developers, the home builders, who have their habits and practices and have become very comfortable feeling that this is a way that they know how to make a profit, and they don't really want to change the way they're doing things. They certainly don't want to learn how to do it differently. It comes from the bankers. The banking world has changed in some very dangerously perverse ways over the last 20 years. And one of the most insidious changes has been that as the local banks were taken over by conglomerates, the lending decisions that they made, especially about real estate projects, no longer had anything to do with the merit of the project. You know, was it a good thing to do? It had only to do with whether or not the particular loan or mortgage could be rebundled with a whole bunch of other mortgages and then resold to some other institution. And that was solely the basis of the decisions made. Now, the ramifications of that are that if you propose to do a good new urbanist project, namely, let's say, to build a five-story apartment building in downtown Atlanta, where they need buildings like that because they need an alternative to the single-family home, the banks will not lend you the money to build it because they don't recognize that as the kind of rebundleable, resellable mortgage that they have had experience with in the past. But that's just inertia. Just because they don't know how to do it, they will not do it. Doesn't mean that it's not a good loan, just means they won't do it. And of course, there's plenty of inertia coming from the home buyers themselves who have certain expectations for a certain kind of a house. Now, that comes from another very strange area in this sort of the darker kind of Jungian backwaters of our national psychology. The origins of suburbia in America really come from the fact that our cities and towns grew up in tandem with the Industrial Revolution and all of its obnoxious procedures and byproducts. And so really, pretty early in American history, which is not that long, let's say the mid-19th century, just around the 1850s, the idea develops as these towns and cities are burgeoning with their factories that the industrial city is a horrible place and it's really not fit for living in. And as soon as we can, we're going to try to get out of it if we can and live outside of it somehow. And after the Civil War, the interruption of the Civil War, the railroad begins to enable the escape from the city in the form of the railroad suburb. The very first one is actually 1859 or 57, just before the Civil War. It was a project called Llewellyn Park in New Jersey. But really the next significant one is Riverside, outside of Chicago, begun in, I think, 1871 or so, designed by the famous Frederick Law Olmsted and his partner Calvert Vaux. And the idea was they were going to build a whole bunch of country manor houses in a kind of a park 9 miles outside of the downtown of Chicago. And that became the prototype for the suburban subdivision and the prototype for what would pretty soon become known as the American Dream. And that becomes firmly established in our national imagination. Everybody who can live outside the horror of the industrial city will. And, of course, you know, in the beginning, only the very well-off can afford to do this. The basic promise of the railroad suburb is you're going to be able to live an urban life in a rural setting. You know, that is, you can work in an office, you can work for a corporation, you can be part of the great industrial dynamic economy of the late 19th century, but you don't have to live in it. You can live outside in the tranquil countryside. And back then, in 1871, it really was a countryside. You know, there were no 7-Elevens in Olmsted's Riverside. If you wanted to make a chocolate cake, you literally went out to the hen house and to the barn, and you got eggs and milk. These people did keep chickens and cows. Of course, the households were organized in a completely different way than they are today. They had servants who did all these things. And that was the American dream, life in the suburbs. And it must have been lovely, actually, when you think about it. You know, the idea of the railroad and later the streetcar suburbs of the late 19th and early 20th century, the Beaux-Arts, is a lovely, lovely kind of package. The trouble is, it becomes, you know, democratized in a certain way after the automobile comes in, especially after 1918, after the interruption of the First World War. And the car changes all that. So really over the next 60, 70 years, and skipping over the other interruptions of the Great Depression and World War II, the suburb goes through this mutation in which it becomes something quite different. It's no longer really country living. It becomes something more kind of sinister and pathetic and pitiful. It becomes a cartoon of country living. In fact, it's a cartoon of a country house set in a cartoon of a rural landscape. And that, of course, is the great unexpressed agony of the suburbs. And it's the reason why the suburbs are so easily subject to ridicule, including ridicule on the part of the people who actually live in it. They, too, recognize that at some level, suburbia is ridiculous. And I think that what's at the bottom of that is, of course, it has not delivered what it promised for, you know, 90 years. It's no longer country living, this cartoon rural existence. And living in a cartoon is just not good enough. You know, one of the great sad lessons among the many diminishing returns of technology that we've learned over the last 100 years is that the virtual really isn't an adequate substitute for the authentic. And it's true in many, many, many ways, but it's certainly true in the sense of the places that we live in. You know, a cul-de-sac subdivision is not an adequate replacement for living in a real neighborhood or a genuine town or a genuine village where you actually enjoy real civic relations. That's sort of the dark story of how we got to where we are. We are now in the unfortunate situation of having now invested so much of our previous wealth in it. We're in what I call the previous investment trap, which probably is self-evident. We've allocated so much of our national wealth in it that we're psychologically unable to find a way to move on to something else. Nor can we understand how we may possibly recoup our misinvestment in this. I mean, it's in the nature of misinvestments that they're not really recoupable, and that's what we're presented with. All of this was a product of the cheap oil age, which really starts at the beginning of the 20th century. And so the whole 20th century has represented this process. We're now leaving this behind us, and the suburban way of life and everything it represents has become so completely normative to most Americans, including ones who are intelligent, that it is very hard for us to imagine any other way of life, including ways of life which at another level we recognize as being more desirable. You know, people do, after all, pay premium prices to travel to Europe to live for a few weeks every year in these far superior urban environments and town environments. You know, people like me